Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. I am John Iderola, still under lockdown, day 506. It feels like, at least, judging by my liver. But we've got a big day of news, and an equally big commentator joining us. Jordan Ewell, welcome back to the Damage Report.
John, thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. Excited to have you comment on, you know, all the big news floating around there, including some that we're going to see if we can fit in, but especially... we're going to have a little open discussion about some research you've been doing on military recruitment, focusing on the gamer generation, which I think is going to be really interesting. So I can't wait to get to that. How have you been recently?
Fine. I don't know, all things considered. That's a load. I don't know. I try to think about how to frame that question anymore because you don't want to put people into a situation. Not saying you did, but generally speaking, I'm trying to put people in a situation where they have to kind of sit with what this moment that we're all in. But, you know, I'm healthy, so that's good.
Yes, you're 100% right. You're right. I need to think about that more. Yeah, it's really developing into something. This second wave, you would imagine we're gonna take it seriously this time, but we've got some evidence today that might not actually be the case. And we're also gonna do a little bit more of a focus in just a few minutes on the economic crisis, the one that's been acknowledged, and the ones that are creeping up behind it that have not yet been. If you are already here and watching, please hit the like button. You can share the stream, and if you would like to chat along, send in tweets #TDRLive. Comment on Twitch or send super chats. We will be responding to those as we go. Lots of news to get to. So Jordan, why don't we jump into it and see if we make up a little bit of time by the end of the show, maybe we can mention the bravery of Sentris in as a final comment. I'm not going to say anything more yet, but anyway, we'll see if we can get to it. Okay, let's do this thing. We get that, along with the pandemic, there has been an incredible amount of economic suffering. Tens of millions of people lost their jobs in a very short period of time, and many of those who were lucky enough to keep them find that things are very difficult. So many people on the brink of losing their homes, losing their businesses, being kicked out of their apartments, and all of that. This is something that you can't just sort of talk away, although some have tried. With Donald Trump continuing to tweet things like this, the lamestream media is not talking about what is happening with the stock market and jobs. Both are doing great. The radical left will destroy the USA. Be careful what you wish for. Okay, yeah, the stock market is improving. And we have learned over the past few months, Jordan, how closely linked the health of the stock market and the American working class is. But anyway, while he's trying to pretend that everything is fine there, behind the scenes, they're at least trying to do a little bit to reassure people that they're taking this seriously, although some of their attempts as of this morning seem a little bit inadequate. So we have this, a new White House-backed ad campaign aims to encourage people who are unemployed or unhappy in their jobs or careers to go out and find something new. This campaign is a product of the White House's American Workforce Policy Advisory Board, which Trump created back in 2018. The board is co-chaired by Trump's daughter and White House advisor, Ivanka Trump, and Commerce Secretary and living fossil, Wilbur Ross. So the idea is just get out there and find something new. If you lost your job due to the pandemic, just go out there and, you know, like, hand your resume to people. And if you don't like your job, quit your job. Find something new. Now is a time of opportunity.
I mean, this is kind of the quintessential just careless right-wing attitude toward workers, right? It's always been, oh, if you can't afford healthcare, get a better job. If you can't afford rent, get a better job. Well, yeah, okay. Wages have been stagnant for years, and now we're at a moment, like you said, where half the country is out of work. And a third of the country can't afford their mortgage payments. We're not in some mass hiring event. I mean, and now we're seeing, as you and I talked about before the show started, we're seeing even more rollbacks in places like California, who were thought to be kind of leading the way on this front. Like, we're seeing another wave. So things aren't going to get better anytime soon. We're not going to see mass rehiring. We're not going to see tons of jobs opening up. What we're seeing is a lot of companies taking bailout money or paycheck protection money from the government and then laying people off. Mm-hmm. So this is the situation we're in. This is the moment we're in. we're not, this comment strikes, and this initiative strikes me as completely tone deaf and callous from a bunch of millionaires and billionaires who really don't care about you or I.
Exactly. Like, it's not like there couldn't be some situation where, hey, we're encouraging people to look into, you know, like certifications and job retraining and things like that. Okay, fine. That seems fine. But when you've gone literally months into this pandemic, not only not providing any economic leadership in terms of making sure that people are taken care of during these incredibly difficult times, but actively fighting against them, as we'll turn to in just a little bit, the idea that you'll just roll out, hey, buck up, find a new opportunity. Not we're going to provide a new opportunity or anything like that. Just go out and do it. As if, has there been a more difficult time to conduct a job search than right now in our entire lives? I don't know that there are. But honestly, the idea that this board co-chaired by Ivanka Trump would be disconnected from the reality of everyday working Americans is kind of easy to believe. I mean, she says, there's never been a more critical time for Americans of all ages and backgrounds to be aware of the multiple pathways to career success and gain the vocational training and skills they need to fill jobs in a changing economy. Well, look, it is a critical time for Americans. I'm not sure she's the one we should talk to, especially considering she's talking there about pathways to career success. Ivanka, you've been given all of your jobs by your father. All of them. That's the only reason anyone knows who you are, that you're in charge of a board, is because opportunities were handed to you by your father, whose fortune was handed to him by his father. I don't know who we should be taking less advice from than members of this family right now.
Yeah, and you see this kind of ignorance reflected in economic recovery packages. Like, I'm just sitting here thinking about where I was in 2008. And how tough it was to find work, how difficult it was for my friends and family to find jobs after losing their jobs. Some people, in many cases, they're losing their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And to think what my reaction might have been if the president was like, "Oh, just go get a new job." Where? Mm-hmm. Where do we go?
Mm-hmm.
So my heart goes out to people in that situation right now, and it's just like I have nothing but contempt for Ivanka, for Trump, for Wilbur Ross, all these people who think that, you know, just going and finding a new job is completely realistic and it's on you, the worker. That's just, it's so tone deaf.
Yeah. Now, does your opinion change when you find out that funding for this board and the ad initiative was provided by 20 corporations and organizations, including Apple, IBM, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce?
Of course it was.
Does that reassure you? So here's the thing. Of course it was. And then, okay, Apple, hire. IBM, hire. Chamber of Commerce, I don't even really know what you do. Give money to people. You're not going to. So here's the thing. We are in, feels like month 12, I think it's month 5 of the pandemic, and people have been hurting in their jobs. They're lucky to have them if they have them. I know from the experience of some of the people I'm closest to in the world that if you end up on unemployment, good luck to you in the first couple of months of this pandemic getting the aid that was provided. Hypothetically, it's there if you're lucky enough to get through to someone and navigate this Byzantine bureaucracy that they've set up and understaffed. So I would have a humble suggestion. Ivanka Trump and the rest of this board, Wilbur Ross, save a little bit of time in the meetings that you're having for this board. Man the phones at the unemployment agency so that people can actually get the help that they desperately need to not be thrown out on the street, to be able to put food in their stomachs. That is the help that people need. They don't need you to just say, you can do it. Come up with a new career. Learn to code, as the meme goes. We know that so many people remain unemployed. And while many people have gotten basically nothing from the government, there was the $1,200 stimulus check. One thing that the government did provide was enhanced unemployment benefits, $600 additional if you were able to qualify for unemployment and you're actually able to get it. That, however, has had a ticking clock on it, that by the end of July, that's going to be gone. And it has taken up until just, we're 2 weeks away from that date, that hypothetically the administration is now indicating that they might be willing to do something. Senior Trump administration officials have been signaling the willingness to approve a narrow extension of those enhanced unemployment benefits. So what could that possibly look like? Well, understand going into it that for months, Trump and White House officials have been arguing that that unemployment bonus is a disincentive to work and should be scrapped, that it's a bad thing, okay? But what might they be willing to do? Well, one compromise would be cutting the benefit from $600 per week to about $200 to $400 per week, and maybe making up at least part of the difference by sending another round of $1,200 stimulus payments. So if you have been suffering jobless week after week after week, that $600, you've been living large. $200 to $400, you could probably make do with that. And maybe there will be another one-time payment that hopefully can take care of a good portion of your rent one time.
Yeah, this is completely inadequate. And I think about how people who there was a story earlier this week where employers were saying, oh, the unemployment is just too lucrative. We can't find anyone to hire. Mm-hmm. And this was based like purely on like a handful of people, anecdotal evidence, stuff like that. And I thought to myself, like, if you're in a situation where unemployment is paying people more than you would at your job, the problem isn't unemployment. The mm-hmm. problem is that you're not paying enough. You're not paying workers enough. Why would anyone want to come work for you? So to deride that system, I think, is just foolish. And it was perpetuated by you know, folks who are sympathetic to business interests in the media. As for this program, I think we need to talk about the complexity and how when you have these kind of multifaceted, like Rube Goldberg style aid packages where you've got, okay, you've got this, and then we'll do maybe we'll negotiate somewhere between 200 and 400, and then we'll do another stimulus. By complicating it like that instead of one streamlined, straightforward payment, it makes it way more susceptible to attacks and cuts. Mm-hmm. And I think people need to understand that when we stay strong and we fight for a unified, single benefit, a robust benefit package, without these types of additional like add-ons and other stimulus things like that, it makes it way harder to attack from the right for budget hawks. Mm-hmm. So people need to understand that. And when we talk about these types of things as it goes forward the next couple of weeks, keep that in the front of your mind and keep pushing for a unified single package.
Yeah, and let's just acknowledge, I mean, we might be launching in a couple of weeks of maybe conversations in DC and maybe something will actually happen. But let's bear in mind that in the first chunk of the pandemic, the first 4 or 5 months as we launch into the second wave, the administration has been quite successful. Republicans have been quite successful, not in fighting the virus. They surrendered on that a long time ago. But in terms of taking this emergency and not having it turn into a significant amount of aid going to the sort of people that they don't care about, they've been pretty good at that. They kept it limited, a little bit of limited unemployment, a one-time stimulus. The most expensive thing they put together was just loans to businesses. They would have been fine doing that under any circumstances. They don't need a pandemic to do that. And so it's going to be interesting to see if they maintain their success going to this. You mentioned there the fact that if temporarily making as much off of unemployment is this big disincentive, that's obviously an indictment of the money that's being offered by these companies. But let's also bear in mind, there might be some other reason that people are not eager to immediately run out and join a new job. And that is that people look out at America and they realize people don't take the pandemic seriously. Employers don't take it seriously. The government still doesn't take it seriously. Why should I rush out there and possibly expose myself to a deadly virus when I can at least for a couple more weeks possibly hunker down and not die? I know for people like Ivanka, that seems insane. I get tested and everyone around me gets tested constantly. Why would people be worried about this? But for regular people, especially clustered in certain sorts of jobs, that has got to be at the front of their mind. Imagine you have a family, you have kids, saying, you know what, I think I'm going to get out there premature. I'm going to forego the unemployment and I'm going to start working again. Imagine the response from your family that you'd be bringing back potentially the virus to them. And they don't seem to acknowledge that at all. If you're not going to take the virus seriously, you can't be surprised that the economy doesn't immediately jump back to full productivity.
Yep.
One last question for you. So we're seeing, you know, that they might be willing to do some limited thing. Lurking behind it is that they've got to get that the economic difficulties, which they don't care about necessarily in moral sense, but politically it's got to be hurting them. They can see the polls and all of that. Do you think that that might lead them to take this a little bit more seriously, or at least want to give an indication to people that they've got their back, considering that we're now less than 4 months away from the election?
Yeah, I think it'll be, you know, once it becomes way more real and tangible for a lot of people, then they'll start to kind of understand. I hope, at least, this is what, I mean, I think a rational person would do in their situation. But I think they're closely looking at, you know, polling numbers and seeing, like, how far they can get without actually spending anything on this. The, you know, kind of the placating messages with the point, like, he pointed to in his tweet. And he's going to have, like, the kind of chorus at Fox backing him up. But, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I think he might get desperate as it gets to November. But it's, I mean, this isn't going away, and it's only going to get worse. I think the next 2 months are going to be really ugly as it becomes real for a lot of people. We like talked about earlier, mortgage crisis, homelessness crisis.
Exactly.
It's going to spike.
Which I haven't heard in these talks about, like, oh, you know, maybe a little bit more unemployment. I haven't heard anything about extending a nationwide, you know, foreclosure ban or, you know, protections from eviction or anything like that. And that, I mean, people were talking about that literally months ago, that we've got to do something about this. Well, months have passed, and the people who control the reins of power haven't done anything. The thing that gives me a little bit of hope is that it's not just on Trump to get how stupid his strategy is and how much it might hurt him individually. You also have Republican senators who don't want to lose their jobs come November. And we know that some of them are polling really poorly. Maybe they'll be willing to do some sort of deal. And if they do pass something in the Senate and the House, it seems difficult at that point for Trump to veto it. Not impossible. Crazier things have happened. But I don't know. That might play into it.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I don't know about you, but I haven't seen much from Dr. Fauci now in literally weeks. He still does appearances, but they tend not to be sort of big front and center presentations of the government's stance on the coronavirus. But he did have a virtual conversation just recently hosted by Stanford Medicine, where he was pretty critical of the U.S. response to coronavirus so far and had this to say about the fact that many states are now seeing absolute explosions of the virus. He said, "We did not shut down entirely, and that's the reason why we went up. We started to come down, and then we plateaued at a level that was really quite high, about 20,000 infections a day. Then, as we started to reopen, we're seeing the surges that we're seeing today as we speak." And he went on to say, "We made a set of guidelines a few months ago. Unfortunately, it did not work out very well for us. We can get a handle on that. I am really confident we can if we step back. You don't necessarily need to shut down again, but pull back a bit and then proceed in a very prudent way." So look, Jordan, I think obviously he's right about the first time. The rush to reopen, we criticized it at the time. It was premature, and it has had the consequences that we predicted. I do find it interesting that Fauci is not calling for total shutdowns again, even though some states are worse hit now than they were in the first wave. What do you think about that?
I worry about what he's saying and how it might be impacted by what we're seeing out of the White House and how they're seeking to discredit him. Not that he would lie or mislead, but I worry about how he's tempering his language to kind of try to stay in somewhat good graces, even though this might be a futile effort, but at least to try to stay in good graces just so he doesn't get fired, because maybe his rationale and his calculation is, hey, at the very least, maybe it's maybe someone here will listen to me, and if he's just in there a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. So I do worry about what he's, you know, just generally speaking, what he's doing and why he might be out of the spotlight. I mean, the likely reason why he's out of the spotlight is they won't let him get in front of a camera because they don't want him to contradict the president.
Well, I mean, they've been apparently blocking interviews, not for all media outlets, but for a number of them. And we've reached out to him. He hasn't been on here. So apparently the White House has a vendetta against TDR. Or he doesn't care. But yeah, you think that he might be sort of trying to thread the needle on this?
Yeah, I think a lot of people's calculations, even at the beginning, because people were trying to hype up that tension between Fauci and Trump. You remember that at the beginning? Mm-hmm. And other people were kind of warning, like, let's not do this. Like, this doesn't need to be like an us against Trump thing, because this guy's an expert. Let's have him at least in proximity to top decision makers. And I think it's better in the long run, if even he's maligned, that he's there at least espousing his opinion.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, you know, I know you said, like, you know, not saying he's lying or anything, but like the thing is, like, do I trust him? Generally, yes. But I don't believe in having any gods in politics. And if I did, it wouldn't be him. I trust him more than any other public face of the government response to this pandemic. And I think while I'm not ready to have like a cartoon of him on my shirt or anything like some people are, I do think it's important that we have someone that is trusted, because so few people have earned any trust since the beginning. Literally, the biggest faces in politics and media have been universally wrong about this. And I'm talking about in media. I'm talking mostly about like Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, stuff like that. They've been lying from the very beginning. So it's important to have Dr. Fauci. And that is why you alluded to the White House campaign against him. That's not what I want to see. And I really did think that we had gotten past that. That tension you talked about, like that fired up a couple of times. And there were these sort of public disagreements about the White House press conferences. I thought that once they stopped those and Trump, you know, basically forgot that there was a pandemic happening, I thought we were out of the woods on the whole plot to take down Fauci. But the thing is that Fox never got off of that. They've been demonizing him this entire time. Conspiracy theories have been brewing up about him and, you know, any manner of connections to Bill Gates and all that stuff. And so it was perhaps premature to think that we had gotten past that. And now we're where we're at, which is the White House basically sending out opposition research against him while Kayleigh McEnany tries to pretend that she doesn't know what people are talking about.
I don't know what to say anymore. It's like, I knew this was going to be a bad 4 years. I don't think I could have imagined, or maybe anybody could have imagined, it would get this bad. Mm-hmm. That they're just attacking, you know, an expert from the CDC in the middle of a global pandemic. Like, it's just...
Well, and it's attacking bizarre. The CDC. Like, yeah. The Chuck Woolery tweet that Trump retweeted. Like, remember he wore the mask and got a bunch of credit and then immediately started going back to attacking science afterward? But anyway, so, look, the crazy thing is, I learned recently, Fauci hasn't been in direct contact with the president in more than 5 weeks. Like, think about how much has changed in the pandemic in 5 weeks. New world epicenters have been established in the U.S., in multiple U.S. states. And what do we have as a response? We have this. White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications and Director of Social Media, Daniel Scavino Jr., shared this, Dr. Fawcett, with his... I don't even know what, like, that Fauci killed the NFL season and schools should be staying closed. That's just Fauci. The indefinite lockdowns. Like, insane Ben Garrison cartoons about Fauci that, like, the top digital messenger for the White House is gleefully spreading. But we're supposed to believe that it's not opposition research. I mean, they're not trying to take him down or anything like that.
I know.
I don't know what to say either. But it is,
it's going
to
get bad. It's going to get bad. And everyone else, I mean, this is an anecdote that, you know, I'm not a wrestling fan, but my buddies are. And there's apparently a Japanese wrestling league that is already back to having events with crowds because they were so responsible at the onset that they're now in a position where their infections are so low. Transmission is so low there now that they're already back to having events.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. We have to think about that in the spirit of collectivism that countries like Japan have that allows them to do that so quickly. And here we are, where deputy communications or communications directors for the president are maligning a medical expert. Mm-hmm. I cannot comprehend it.
Yeah, they're having events, whereas we started opening up, not just before we got a handle on the virus, but before we had the testing apparatus to know what the state of the virus was in a lot of states. We honestly did, like, Georgia and Texas and Florida, all of them started reopening before we had any idea what was actually going on. And they didn't do it because scientists were saying, well, this looks safe. They did it because, you know, 5% of the country, the craziest right-wingers, started protesting about the Constitution being shredded. I'm assuming Japan probably didn't have that. So they have a few things up on us. And another reason that Trump and the White House might again be going for Fauci is the same reason as always: ratings. Trump, according to the Washington Post, is apparently mad that Fauci is still popular. People, you know, trust him. 67% of voters trust him for information on coronavirus, compared with 26% who trust Trump, which isn't even his normal base, which means even some of them don't necessarily trust him. And the thing is, for Trump, it's not improving. Like, the percent who disapprove of his response has been trending up, and the gap is as big as it has been at any point in this pandemic, which is important, too, because I've been, I think, rightfully frustrated by people's apparent lack of continuing concern about the pandemic. But that doesn't mean that they've switched back to thinking Trump is doing a great job. They might have sort of detached from the news, but they maintain their anger at the way that the government has flubbed this entire thing. But anyway, yeah, I agree with you. The fact that the only thing that seems to get the White House fired up during this pandemic is cutting unemployment benefits and attacking the CDC, that's not what you'd want in month five of a pandemic. The U.S. is once again federally in the business of murder, with the U.S. carrying out the first federal execution in 17 years at a prison in Indiana after a 5-4 Supreme Court ruling cleared the way. Love those 5-4 Supreme Court rulings that have the power of life and death. Daniel Lewis Lee, who was convicted of killing an Arkansas family in a plot to establish a whites-only nation, was executed by lethal injection early Tuesday. His execution, the first brought by the Federal Bureau of Prisons since 2003. Some of you watching this might not have even been born the last time the federal government carried out an execution, was initially halted on Friday over concerns about the coronavirus pandemic, which were raised by civil rights groups and relatives of Lee's victims who had sued to try to stop it. The reason for that is that many of the relatives of the victims don't want him to die. They believe that a life sentence in prison is punishment enough. But he did. After a short stay right before the execution, he stayed strapped to his gurney for 4 hours awaiting execution, just for a little bit more cruelty before the state, again, decided who lives and who dies. Yeah.
I mean, this is tough because, I mean, this guy was, like, I think a white supremacist and, you know, I think it was like a racially motivated crime. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, like, for how barbaric the death penalty is and how cruel it is, and even like you just said, keeping him waiting for hours before they kill him, like, that's pretty sadistic. That's twisted. What we need to understand about these types of cases is they start with things like this, where the most rational among us are sympathetic to the mm-hmm. government's actions because this guy's a racist and he's a despicable person. But what if the line is what if it's a little bit more blurry? Mm-hmm. What if it's someone who, you know, the case is kind of up in the air. Maybe they were convicted as a minor. You know, things like that, it becomes a little more difficult. But what we need to do is, if we oppose the death penalty, and I would encourage everyone watching to understand that we should not do this. We should not kill people as punishment, because we're no better than anybody else then. What we need to do is stand up against all cases, regardless of the crime or how heinous it is, for even the worst, like this white supremacist. And there's a book that I would encourage people to read. It just got turned into a movie, but I really would stress that you read the book, Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. He details his time dealing with death row inmates and helping, you know, trying to get some of them to reduce sentences or off, or you know, off completely if they were innocent and or wrongly convicted. Just fantastic work, and it really shows that like no one is defined by their worst act. Like no one, everyone has a little bit of good in them. We just need to work with them. Killing them is not going to solve the problem. You know, some people might be, you know, way harder, 99% chance that they don't change, but like we can't kill people as punishment. It's so barbaric and cruel.
Exactly. Yeah, and you think about, you know, how many people have been executed that didn't actually do the crime. Like every one of those could and should be a movie. The idea that someone could spend years or decades in prison and then be killed by the state knowing the entire time that they didn't do it. Many of their family and friends probably started to believe that they did. Imagine the injustice. But we kill them, and thus we get, I don't know, what do we get? So this guy, he says he didn't do it. Let's say that he did, because he probably did. Seems terrible. Seems like a terrible guy. Obviously, a born act. He doesn't have a defender in the world. What do we get now that he's dead? Like, we are once again a state that sanctions murder. We've taught, you know, it's another reminder to Americans that killing is so fundamentally bad that the punishment should be killing. We've taught them that. We've made it, had a demonstration of our values in that way. But what else have we actually gotten for it? I don't know. Another opportunity to potentially kill someone who didn't do it. And since, as you point out, this is how it starts, Barr back last year, moving to reinstate it, and maybe, you know, with a sane president, maybe they'll stop it again, you know, or maybe with a, you know, sort of cruel president, they'll do it just for the worst murders. Or maybe, hypothetically, you could have the federal death penalty revived under, for instance, a president who, you might recall when the Ukraine story first came out, said that spies should be murdered and that the person who leaked it was a spy, so we should deal with them the way that we used to. Now, he didn't end up doing that, but he implied that the person who leaked about the phone call should be killed by the U.S. government. Is that what we want? I would argue no. And I don't think that it should be up to the next insane, cruel person that we give the White House to. Under President Carlson, are you going to want him to be the one who decides who lives and who dies? I'm not. And I'm not comfortable with him choosing Supreme Court justices who are going to be making that decision. Because one of the things that comes out of this 5-4 decision is that Justice Stephen Breyer, joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, reiterated that it might be time to revisit the constitutionality of the death penalty. It might be time. Maybe they'll do it in the next few years. What justices will be on the court when that happens? We had just had a 5-4 decision in favor of going forward right now, so we have kind of an idea. What about that court minus RBG? And then put in a new conservative, would they be more or less likely to say that it's okay for the U.S. government to kill people? And again, the like victims or relatives of the victims are saying things like, for us, it is a matter of being there and saying, this is not being done in our name. We do not want this. But what does that mean? The actual experience of someone who lost someone compared to a conservative looking on this and saying, well, if someone killed my family member, I'd want them dead. This person actually went through the experience, and they're saying that they don't. But screw them; they don't get to weigh in on this.
Yeah.
Let me play
it's,
one.
It's so barbaric.
It absolutely is. And you know, talking about like you know what sort of president we could have had, it would have been nice to have someone like this.
In a world of so much violence and killing, I just don't believe that government itself should be part of the killing.
It's never gonna stop bothering me. The opportunity that we had, that we lost early this year. It could have been so important, so significant. And what better time to provide a clear distinction in terms of morals, in terms of rhetoric, and in terms of substance, all at the same time. That was the opportunity that we had. We found out late last week that Tucker Carlson's head writer was, shockingly, a massive racist. And Tucker didn't address it on his Friday show. He waited until Monday, and here is what he had to say.
Over the weekend, you may have seen stories about a writer on this show called Blake Neff. For years, since he was in college, Blake posted anonymously on an internet message board for law school students. On Friday, many of those posts became public. Blake was horrified by the story, and he was ashamed. Friday afternoon, he resigned from his job. We want to say a couple of things about this. First, what Blake wrote anonymously was wrong. We don't endorse those words. They have no connection to the show. It is wrong to attack people for qualities they cannot control. In this country, we judge people for what they do, not for how they were born. We often say that because we mean it. We'll continue to defend that principle, often alone among national news programs, because it is essential. Nothing is more important. Blake fell short of that standard, and he has paid a very heavy price for it. But we should also point out to the ghouls now beating their chests in triumph at the destruction of a young man that self-righteousness also has its costs. We are all human. When we pretend we are holy, we are lying. When we pose as blameless in order to hurt other people, we are committing the gravest sin of all, and we will be punished for it. There's no question.
Okay, I have a lot of reactions to that. By the way, we left in the little transition because that was all that he had to say about that. The fact that his head writer was a vicious, vicious racist. He moved on. My first reaction is Screw Tucker Carlson. That was absolute garbage, that reaction. I have other thoughts, but Jordan, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, Tucker acting upset about Blake Neff is a bit rich because this is the same guy who we uncovered when I was at Media Matters audio of him saying, immigrants make the country dirtier and poorer and more divided, that Iraq is a country filled with semi-literate primitive monkeys, women making more in the workplace lead to the decline of men, multiple racist comments on that show Bubba the Love Sponge, comments about underage women, just a whole litany of disgusting, despicable things. I didn't see specifically what Blake wrote, but I can't imagine it's any different than what Tucker says on his own show or calling into shock jock radio shows. So, I mean, this is somebody who wrote for Tucker at the Daily Caller. He wrote an article about celebrating indigenous people getting hit with cars at a protest, said they got run over by superior technology. Terrible, terrible stuff at the Daily Caller. So you kind of knew what this guy's worldview was to make him your head writer and having so closely aligned views. Shouldn't really surprise anybody, but now he's fiending outrage and clutching his pearls over people coming for him when you knew who the guy was.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, white supremacy is a hoax. Diversity isn't a strength. When has it ever been a strength? These are not things that someone secretly wrote on a forum. This is something that a person gleefully said to millions and was paid millions of dollars to say. I hate the stuff that Blake Neff said, but Blake Neff could go the rest of his life trying as hard as he could, and he would never be the racist that Tucker Carlson is. Because Blake Neff, he's a personal bigot. He hates people who are different than him. Women, people who are black, Asian people, all of that. Tucker Carlson stands for the continuation of white supremacy in our political and economic systems. That is so much worse. But you get away with it because Tucker hasn't yet said the N-word on air. Maybe if he said that, there'd be something, but maybe not. Now, to his comments, which were brief, 1 minute and 17 seconds after we found out that your head writer, when all you do is read off of a teleprompter, it's not like he occasionally does a segment and the rest of it's just pure Tuck. No, he was the one crafting your message. So if you had just watched that, and you hadn't read the actual reporting by Oliver Darcy, you would have no idea what Neff actually said. Did you notice that Tucker never even acknowledged it was racist or had anything to do with race? He never admitted that Neff said the N-word or any of this stuff. Spent years in a forum attacking some woman he knows. Literally years posting about some random woman. He gives you none of the content, which leaves a Fox News viewer thinking, oh, he did something, I guess. And he did it since he was in college, so I guess it was a while ago when he was young. And he's ashamed, after all. He's ashamed, maybe, that he was caught. He's not ashamed of the comments, because the comments were up until just a couple of weeks ago. He did it for years. It wasn't something that he wrote a really long time ago, and we can have a conversation about how far the bounds of forgiveness go. He was saying it now, during this moment, during the pandemic, during the civil rights protests. The idea that he's ashamed, doesn't acknowledge what the content was, doesn't acknowledge the fact that having a racist like that writing your monologues might impact the show. In fact, he specifically says it has no connection to the show. How could it not? How does what your head writer think about politics and ideology and race, if that has no impact on the show, what the hell is your show? What's going into those monologues if the personal views of the people who craft them has nothing whatsoever to do it? Except that of course it does. But it is convenient to pretend that there's some sort of adamantium wall between you and Blake Neff. Just say there's no connection, even if there clearly is. One or two other quick things. I love that he says, we don't attack people for things they can't change. Now, when you acknowledge that what he was saying was racist stuff, attacking black people, that makes it seem as if, yeah, it is bad, but we don't say it. That's not the problem with racism, that you just don't vocalize the hatred that is at the very core of you as a person. What a weird thing for Tucker Carlson to say there. And then he says, we will continue to stand for the principle that we attack people for what they do, not what they are, often alone among national news programs. Oh, do you not get it? They're the least racist. In fact, the fact that he has a racist head writer allows him to demonstrate how he's better than all the other shows on this very topic. But that doesn't mean he's not mad at people. He's mad at the reporters, the ghouls, who think it's a good thing that the biggest news show in the country no longer has an explicitly racist writer. Those people are beating their chest over a racist losing their job. Those are the true bad people. And he fit all of this in 1 minute and 17 seconds. It's truly a masterclass in propaganda and manipulation.
Yeah, this is, you know, as I've had to watch a lot of Tucker and listen to and read a lot of what he's said and written and seen work coming out of the Daily Caller and seeing the long list of white nationalists, including people like Jason Kessler, who organized the Charlottesville rally that led to the death of Heather Heyer. I mean, these are people he had on staff. There's a long list of white nationalists that wrote for the Daily Caller, and I've got Blake Neff writing for his show. And at no point do their views or ideologies break with Tucker's. So for him to go on and kind of espouse this faux sincerity is just a slap in the face to anybody who's even remotely familiar with him or his work.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he never said, you know, I'm appalled that a vicious racist was on my staff. He never says that. Because let's pretend he didn't know. Let's pretend that this guy worked there for years and it never was made clear. Like that this racist didn't go there specifically because he was comfortable in that environment. Let's pretend that all that doesn't exist. He never admits that it was a bad thing that he had a racist writing for him. Like imagine, like we don't have scripts and we don't have teleprompters here, but we have producers. Okay, I have a great producer who preps my interviews with people. Let's say we found out that she was a literal Nazi. And I came out and addressed, sorry, Angel, you're great. And I came out and presented her as the victim, and the bad person would be the person who identified that I had a Nazi prepping some of my interviews. Like, what would you think of me? But the onus should be so much larger for him. He makes more in a year than I'll make in the rest of my life. He broadcast to literally millions of people. And finding out that he had a vicious, unrepentant racist on his staff, that affected him for 1 minute and 17 seconds. And now he gets to go on a vacation because you always know that I guess a racist incident is coming up on Fox News because they plan all of their vacations to happen immediately after it. Mr. Carlson told viewers that he would return to his show next week and described the vacation as long planned, suggesting that his time off had been set before Mr. Neff was revealed on Friday as the author of the offensive posts. Last August, Carlson also went on a vacation. That was 2 days after he likened white supremacy to a hoax, saying it was actually not a real problem in America, which caused some advertisers to flee his show. So I just love that, like, he gets to just go. It was just planned. It has nothing to do with this.
In 2019, spring of 2019, when we released the Bubba the Love Sponge tapes, mm-hmm. In March, 3 days later, Tucker was on vacation. So... Mm-hmm. It's just weird timing. It's just, you know.
No, it is weird. Well, why did you foresight? Plan your story for right before his vacation? Let the guy relax for a bit. What a ridiculous sham. What a see-through sham. But of course, why would Fox do more at this point? Like, whatever advertisers they still have are in it to win it. They get the thing that's going on here. Fox knows what their audience wants. Like, if you think, if Tucker just said the N-word on air, what share of his audience would he lose? What, are they all going to flee? They're going to hate his show? Their main gripe with the world is that they don't get to say the word. They would love for their avatar of rationality and intellectuality to say it for them. What? Why would they do more? Why would they fire him? Why would they suspend him? Why would they perhaps look into other people on Tucker's writing staff? And by the way, he's going to have a new head writer. What, is that person going to be woke? Like, it's just, it's all such a ridiculous sham. And that's why, although we've been sounding the war drums against Tucker Carlson for a long time, because it infuriates me to no end that people pretend that he's reasonable, a potential ally of the left and all that stuff. When the story came out on Friday, I didn't immediately do a live video because my first reaction was, huh, yeah. And my second reaction was, ain't gonna affect anything. It's not gonna matter. He's not gonna lose his job. Nothing's gonna happen. The entire thing is so stupid, so frustrating. If you're watching this right now, perhaps someday in the future, you should know that it is the 14th of July in America. We have just recently passed 135,000 confirmed dead of COVID-19. And we all know at this point everything that needs to be done to stop the pandemic. We're just having this ongoing national conversation about whether we give enough of a damn to do any of it. And as this is going on, the biggest name in news had this to say about the pandemic.
This is what happens when science intersects with politics. Both lose, and the country loses most of all. Keeping kids out of school, keeping the elderly inside, forcing everyone to wear a mask when there's no evidence that helps. All of these become statements of resistance and moral imperatives.
That is Tucker Carlson broadcasting to millions of people last night saying still, 135,000 dead. There is no evidence that masks help at all. There's no scientific reason to believe that a mask would help stop the spread of a virus. And I know, Jordan, we've probably covered him saying this before. And I know, what are you going to say? But come on, that's pretty, I'm not going to say the words, but that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he's just towing the line now that they're just going to try to support Trump and, you know, the White House's new positioning, despite him at the onset, because it directly impacted him. Mm-hmm. He had a scare early on with the Bolsonaro thing at Mar-a-Lago when he was there with them. He was a little bit more serious at the beginning, and people were just kind of like hapless and being like, wow, Tucker Carlson's taking it seriously. Now Trump is listening to Tucker on this. And it's like, okay, no, obviously not, because now look, here we are in July, and that's clearly not the case. But the break from Tucker's earlier comments show that really at the end of the day, he's a party guy and he's a Fox guy. He likes to position himself as the bold truth teller on Fox that will stick it to power. But, you know, from partying, like I said, partying with Trump at Mar-a-Lago and Bolsonaro to now towing the line on this and deriding science, like, the guy is nothing more than just a shill. He's just a flack for right-wing interests.
100%. And that is why, while I am trying to get people to acknowledge widely, in the same way that Media Matters was so instrumental year after year after year, getting people to understand what Fox News was and break the mythology that had been crafted that they're fair or balanced or anything like that, that Tucker Carlson is a racist, that I think is a pretty easy sell, but that also that he is 100% disingenuous. He is not a critical thinker. He is not bucking the establishment. He's not doing, there's no core that all of these in-depth, like, analyses of him try to find. That doesn't exist. If anything, maybe racism. But that's it. Everything else is contingent on what's going on and what he thinks he can get. And we have a great example of that. So there he said, there is no science to wearing a mask, despite, you know, the obvious cost of saying that. That's what he said yesterday. Now let's flash back to March 31st. Here's Tucker.
Of course masks work. Everyone knows that. Dozens of research papers have proved it. In South Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, the rest of Asia, where coronavirus has been kept under control, masks were key.
Okay, so just in case someone watching this show is a fan of Tucker Carlson, perhaps a fan of Donald Trump, and doesn't get it just yet how much he's manipulating you.
Forcing everyone to wear a mask when there's no evidence that helps. Of course masks work. Forcing everyone to wear a mask when there's no evidence that helps. Of course masks work. Forcing everyone to wear a mask when there's no evidence that helps. Of course masks work.
Okay, so one is late March, one is July. What has changed? Well, the pandemic's only gotten worse. So all of the pressure to get the science right would lead him to have been wrong before, but right now, he's moved in the opposite direction, which means that he is reading the room. He's reading the conservative base. He has been part of training them that lockdowns are wrong, that all of this is a big hoax, you don't have to pay attention to it, there should be no inconvenience whatsoever for you. That is what has changed. It's not like those scientific articles that he was referencing in March were debunked or anything like that. If anything, there's more evidence on top of the common sense that masks help viruses stop transmitting orally. Obviously, the only thing that's changed is he thinks that his bread is buttered by implying that all of this is fake and you don't have to pay attention to it, which is why we should never allow a person for a single second to pretend that Tucker Carlson is reasonable or a critical thinker or anything other than Sean Hannity with a tighter script. That's all it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we talked about it earlier, the countries he lists, he's talking about, you know, Southeast Asian countries and East Asian countries. We talked about it earlier. Japan's already back to having events. Mm-hmm. I mean, they banded together. They understood what they needed to do. They socially distanced. They wore masks, and there they are. And now, what are we doing? We're hemming and hawing over the efficiency of masks. We're just the laughingstock of the planet. Mm-hmm. Countries don't want Americans coming there. I mean, what? Go off, Tucker. I guess this is so reckless.
Yeah, you know, when you reference how well some countries have done, I know that people must think like, man, what do they have that let them get through this with so little deaths? Do they have some sort of secret treatment or secret vaccine? No, it's not about what they have. It's about what they don't have. They don't have Tucker Carlson. And people like him. Ben Shapiro is probably not that popular in Japan. If I had to guess, I would say. We don't have this media infrastructure that billionaires have been pumping money into for literally decades to convince people that when a pandemic knocks on your door, you should open the door and breathe in heavily. That is what we have. And it's killing people. More and more people every day turning to Twitch to unwind a little bit, relax, maybe learn a little bit of strategy for some of the games you're interested in. But what if your new Twitch habit landed you in the U.S. military? Well, that is apparently a growing possibility. And Jordan Ewell, you've been at the forefront of documenting this new trend. What is going on with the U.S. military and Twitch?
So all the branches except for the Marines have launched esports initiatives and Twitch channels to increase their presence there in a gaming-oriented context. And what I found was, partially through just some lighthearted trolling, but I noticed that they were using these channels to recruit. And the Army especially has one of the biggest initiatives on this front. They sponsor the Call of Duty League.
Wow.
And within this recruiting context, they have like multiple different links and forms and automated messages in their chat encouraging people to sign up for contests. And what these contests are ultimately recruiting forms disguised as contests. And there's nothing you can win. That it doesn't appear to be anything you can win because there's no mention of like odds or stakes or prizes or drawings or anything like that. It's just, you know, big bold letters, register to win. You click it and it's a recruiting form. And while one second you might be watching them play Call of Duty, the next second you're filling out your information, giving it to a recruiter to be, you know, pressured by a recruiter. And I think it's especially concerning because the minimum age to be on Twitch is 13. Wow. And the minimum age to be recruited is 16. And now we're heading into a moment where we talked about earlier in the show. half the country is out of work, and a third of people can't afford their mortgage, and it's only going to get worse. We're going to see a spike in homelessness. We're going to see a spike in evictions. People are dying. People might lose their parents or grandparents. People are losing their – more and more people are losing their jobs. Recruiters prey on people in unstable situations because the military, to them, offers you a stable paycheck, a steady income, you know, a roof over your head. It offers you stability for the foreseeable future. And you're going to have people in vulnerable situations, desperate for help, the government not helping, and a predatory recruiter on Twitch hanging out with you in chat day after day after day, hammering you to join the military. And I think that something needs to be done. I think Twitch needs to better police its content on this front. There needs to be way more transparency about the recruiting efforts itself. And there should be safeguards to prevent 13-year-olds from sitting in these rooms that really should be 18 and older. But ultimately, like, you should not have 13, 14, 15-year-old kids hanging out with a recruiter. The people on stream are effectively recruiters for the military, recruiters who are just good at video games.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And they're hyping up the military. They do not portray accurately the trauma and just grotesque nature of war. It's something that'll leave you with a lifetime of PTSD. The suicide rate for veterans is super high. They don't mention any of that. It's just – this is so great. We're flexing on them. Like, we're loving this game. You should join the military. Steady income. You could be a hero. It's so deeply dangerous.
Well, and also, I mean, we were talking about this yesterday. There are a couple things that you found that I think are so amazing. So one of them is, I think you might have tweeted about this, is that it's not just that they're encouraging recruitment. It's that they're encouraging recruitment and pretending that you can join to just join the esports team. Like, no, we're not going to send you to Afghanistan. You just get to, like, wear a uniform and play Call of Duty. What are your odds of that, Jordan?
So the inaugural Navy esports team is 10 people. And the current Navy enlistment is around 325,000 people. Ooh. So, you know, quick odds, not great.
No.
Not great. And typically, just the way the military works is, to be a recruiter, I mean, you're going to need to go through basic training and stuff like that. You're going to need to be in there a few years before you then, after your initial, you know, deployment or contract or whatever, you then transition to other types of positions if you want to be a lifetime military member. You know, usually you go into either – you're like either a sergeant, like, you know, you're doing like drill sergeant stuff. You're working at camps. You're doing recruiting. There's a bunch of different other jobs that you can do after you actually are, like, you know, in the Navy, like a midshipman or a, you know, a seaman or something like that. You're not going to go in and immediately – you're not going to be like, hey, you're new? Yeah, let's go recruit for us. No, you got to go through the indoctrination first.
Yeah.
So you're not signing up to play Call of Duty. You're signing up. You're signing up and giving your life away. And in some cases, you're going to die.
Or kill.
In most cases, you could get killed, or you could end up with a lifetime of PTSD. There are very slim odds of you going in and just being a gamer.
Yeah, 100%. No, I have to assume that your odds are probably better in joining like Cloud9 or TSM or something like that, like the traditional road, you know? I think that that's better. Someone pointed out in the comments, Justin Vigil says, Twitch banned women who would show too much cleavage while streaming, but you're allowed to stream to get people into the U.S. military. That is a weird set of priorities there. Like, you can't be visibly drunk while streaming, but you can stream to get people to join and possibly go off to Iraq and fight. Yeah, absolute madness. And on top of it, it's the dishonesty that you point out. Like, you know, you click on a thing to get an Xbox controller, which lots of streamers have stuff like that, but there's no controller. There's just the recruitment form. And yeah, I wonder, like, are the streams being promoted? Is there money involved? I don't know. But it definitely seems like there has to be transparency.
Yeah, there is promotion involved. I'm working on the finer details of how much money specifically, but all these enterprises, all these efforts have huge promotions and sponsorships and agreements with different esports teams and organizations. The Navy, I believe, pays for prominent placement on Twitch's homepage. The Army, I think, does as well. The Army has been on the front page a lot, and recently was also featured in the Stream with Pride category. Last month, they were featuring pro-LGBTQIA+
streamers and they put the Army's esports team in there. And I want people to think about how ludicrous that is, that the Army, with this long history of discrimination against that community, would be featured in that category. And you have to assume the only way it ended up there was because of some sponsorship or advertising deal.
Yeah, I mean, Trump literally banned transgender individuals from the military. That seems absolutely crazy. And of course, we should acknowledge that this is sort of the most recent version of a thing that the military has been doing for a long time. Like, you know, they do these deals with filmmakers to sort of glorify the military. And think about how more efficient it's become. That now the military just, like, plays Call of Duty or whatever and streams it. Back in the past, they made America's Army. Like, they used to make video games to get people involved. Now they can save tons of money. They just stream other video games. Rocket League, why not, you know? It's like driving a Humvee, but with rockets on it.
And one thing about that is, okay, you might play that game an hour a day, and you're like, oh, okay, this game kind of sucks, whatever. You might go see American Sniper, which is, you know, not more agitprop, more propaganda, and you leave thinking like, oh, all right, whatever, that's fine. Those are all one-off things that you can consume on your own time, and they're very individual and siloed. Here, you are spending hours on end, if you are a reoccurring viewer, hours on end in the same room with a recruiter over and over and over again. And like Hassan Piker will tell you, you'll see the same people over and over again, and they will start to build a relationship with the streamer. So if people are coming again and again, I've been monitoring some of these rooms for a piece I'm working on to say they know the reoccurring chatters. Mm-hmm. Like I see it in my room. I'm sure you guys see it on TYTs. You see the same people every time. And that's how these communities get built. But in a recruiting context, do these people know they're being recruited? And I would argue no, because it's not transparent.
Exactly. Yeah, you should be upfront. Like, the people who watch our stream every day on YouTube or Twitch, they know that I'm trying to get them into my cult. Like, they get that. Okay, I'm upfront about it. The military should be equally upfront. But anyway, great work, Jordan. And, you know, we're obviously looking forward to the article. When it's available, we're going to tweet it out and all of that.
When we talk about climate change and how it's going to impact our world, we tend to speak broadly about big changes over big periods of time. But let's just for a bit focus on the future of one particular city. And joining us now to discuss is the author of Disposable City, Miami's Future on the Shores of Climate Catastrophe, Mario Alejandro Ariza. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
We're glad to have you on. This is the first day that the book is available, correct?
That's right, July 14th, Bastille Day.
Awesome. And so tell me about this decision to focus on Miami, about how climate change is going to affect it, what it might look like, you know, in the not too far off future.
Sure. So climate change can seem like a really abstract concern to a lot of people, right? You can't really see CO2 and the timeline for the effect that humans are having on the climate is pretty vast. Right, it's not like the coronavirus where you wait 2 weeks and see what the effects of a bad decision are. But in a city like Miami, you can already feel the effects of climate change. There's sunny day flooding when there isn't a cloud in the sky and there's water sloshing around the streets of the city. The rains are more intense. The heat is a lot hotter. And it's already having effects on my hometown in such a way that, well, it's kind of got me wondering whether or not this place is going to make it if certain things don't change quickly.
And from the models that I've seen, it seems pretty clear that the path we're on is not one that Miami can survive in anything like its current shape.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of adaptation necessary to survive even just the low end of the sea level rise curves, right? And there are different curves and there are different models, but they're all in general concordance that at some point, a lot of water is going to show up here, even if they can't tell you exactly when. And in order for the city to be able to survive that, two things really need to happen. The city itself needs to do its job in adapting, and the rest of the world needs to start playing along and significantly reducing greenhouse gas emissions in order to give us a fighting chance.
Yeah, and we should, of course, point out that the sort of nightmare scenario is the streets of Miami are flooded permanently. It's underwater. But we know that in the decades leading up to that, ocean level rise combined with extreme weather events means that it's going to suffer from worsening and worsening storms and intermittent flooding, which will be a massive problem leading up to that. And so all of this is to say is I'm curious about the decision to make the project. What are you hoping that someone will take out of this? Perhaps, you know, a greater awareness of the problem, perhaps a willingness to consider solutions?
Yeah, both that. But I mean, the real reason why I wrote this book is because I've got a large circle of friends and family here in Miami that like may understand vaguely what climate change is going to do to the city, but they may not really understand that depending on where they live and the rate of rise of sea level, they may not be able to flush their toilet in their house in 15 to 20 years.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, I mean, the city itself is incredibly vulnerable because of a series of things that make it unique. But there's a lot of cities around the world just like it that are next to the ocean or that rely on a certain resource that climate change is going to make very scarce in my lifetime. And so if you see its effects on one city, the idea is that maybe you can start thinking about the systems that make your city possible and that are going to be changing because of climate change just within your lifetime.
You know, and I know that obviously there's a lot of things that combine to make certain communities more at risk, certain cities more at risk. And I know that one component of that is racism. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So Miami has a not very much discussed, but a very deep history of incredibly awful racial segregation, right? There's actually still a physical wall on Northwest 12th Avenue. Wow. That used to divide black and white neighborhoods. Yeah, it goes on for like 7 or 8 blocks, right? And it's not like painted over a mural like the Berlin Wall, it's just there. And so that inequality that was baked into Miami, you know, and of course you have to layer in the Cuban migrations and all of the later Latin American diasporas that showed up, but that fundamental inequality is still here. And it's playing out in very interesting ways, because when this city was first built, the redlining maps that allowed different races to get different mortgages essentially cordoned off African American communities far away from the ocean onto the high ground. Mm-hmm. Well, now the high ground's getting kind of valuable.
Yeah.
And what are you seeing? You're seeing folks actually actively gentrifying the high ground in order to protect themselves and their investments from climate change. So one of the things that we have to figure out here if we're going to survive is how do we share this limited resource in Dade County of high ground? Mm-hmm.
You know, talking there about, you know, retreating to high ground, trying to sort of get ahead of the problem that we know is coming. I know that nationally, there's this conversation about whether climate change is real or not, not amongst scientists, but amongst people in media and all of that. When you're doing this investigation, you're talking to the people of Miami, is it accepted that this is happening and how severe it is likely to be?
So I would say that in my experience, almost everybody in Miami understands that climate change is happening. Some of them, depending on their ideological alignment, may not attribute it to human sources, but they understand that it's bad and that they see what it's doing to the city. What they may not believe in is necessarily how rapidly things are going to change, or just how little change means means that there's going to be a negative outcome for, you know, their wealth, their health, and their general livelihood here in the city. Because it only takes 6, 7, 8 inches of water and a lack of adaptation, and all of a sudden we can't really drain our city very well. And yeah, when it rains a lot, well, you know, it's gonna get a little moist.
It is, and it seems like what you would have to do in terms of infrastructure to protect Miami seems like it would be a colossal undertaking. Is there conversation about that? Is that something that's in the cards, an attempt to protect Miami as this gets worse and worse?
Yeah, so the Army Corps of Engineers actually has something out right now. It's called the Back Bay Study. It's a $4.6 billion plan. And the entire point of the plan is to protect Miami from one kind of threat. And that is a storm surge from a hurricane. Because if you look at what could really kill this city the quickest, that's it. Big category 5 storm, smack down the middle of the city, like rolling a strike in bowling. Right? And their idea is to build these 12 to 15 foot high walls down certain sections of the city to prevent a big, you know, just storm surge knocking everybody out. But that doesn't necessarily fix the problem of the water seeping in under the limestone soil. That doesn't fix the problem of all the septic tanks. That doesn't fix the problem of all of the environmental injustice that's going on right now. And in fact, may even exacerbate it because they're calculating where to put these interventions based off of property value.
Yeah.
So they're looking at return on investment and they're thinking, oh man, we should really protect the really rich areas. And you're like, oh buddy, that's not really gonna help you.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you know, I know that in the blurb for the book, you write that this is a deeply personal investigation for you. And so I'm curious, like if we, let's say, you know, decades and decades go by and we've lost Miami because we couldn't deal with it nationally, internationally. Obviously the geography would be lost, but so much culture would be lost too. To you personally, what would be the biggest loss if Miami disappeared?
Oh man, I'm afraid my family's gonna get broken up, you know? Like I've got a large, loud, wonderful Hispanic family and we have our disagreements and we have different politics and we can't see each other because of the coronavirus now. But I'm just gonna be afraid that we won't be able to hang out for, you know, somebody's birthday. Yeah. That will be scattered across the United States.
Yeah. Obviously sad. Thankfully, there is still time. If people pay attention to works like yours and take it seriously, maybe we can do something. The book is Disposable City, Miami's Future on the Shores of Climate Catastrophe. Mario, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you so much. You guys have a great day and stay safe out there.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.